Hi, and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through each and every Newbery Medal winning book, and then we talk about it. But not today. What we're doing today is we're wishing everybody a happy new year in March.
Yes.
You want to tell us, tell our esteemed listeners what we're doing?
Yes, we are doing an overview of books that we read in 2024. And we have how many categories? Seven?
One, two, three, four. Yes, seven.
Seven. We have seven categories that we want to share with you guys. We are going to talk about a variety of books. Books that are Newberries and books that are not. And I really wish you'd stop taking my notes away.
Sorry, I was just making sure the volume was okay on Audacity. We've been having some technical difficulties on our end, mostly dealing with my computer.
And then I keep getting sick, so that's another reason why we haven't recorded.
And we're also busy.
Yes.
We need a wealthy person to just bankroll our hobbies so that we don't have to work. We can hire an au pair.
Oh my god.
Anyway, we meant to do this way back in January, like we did last year for 2023, but such is life.
Yes.
So these are the favorite books that we read in 2024?
Yeah, favorites or, you know, ones that we want to talk about, ones that stood out to us. So, yeah. You want to get started?
Are these the same categories we used last year?
Yes,
I don't remember.
These are the same categories that we used last year. So let's start off with our favorite Newbery. What was your favorite Newbery that you read in 2024?
Well, I would say I have loved this book, Jacob Have I Loved by Katherine Patterson, which I'm looking at your notes now. Rebecca, what's your favorite Newbery?
My favorite was also Jacob Have I Loved.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We read some good Newbery Medal winning books in 2024. We read some bad ones. I'm not going to name names of the bad ones. They can feel bad already because they can listen to the previous podcast. But Jacob Have I Loved was really good.
It was. I've thought about that book so much this year and like different frustrations or when you have like just difficult family situations that you're watching people navigate or feelings of, you know, just deep identity questions that people are asking. This book has just been one that's really stood out. And when I think about one book that really moved me and pulled my heartstrings and had a deep sense of pathos, this is the book that won. And I was also thinking a lot about something you said in the podcast when we did this the first time, is that today, this book wouldn't probably even be in the category of a Newbery book because it would be more of a YA book. And I think that you're right. And I also think that I'm just really grateful that YA has become a genre in and of itself to really target those teen readers that need to read books where they feel seen and can really process like the difficult parts of their life. So I'm really grateful for this book and that it was a Newbery at the time, and also that an entire genre exists now to meet that population.
I am also thankful that that genre exists, but I think that this book is better for not existing within that genre, because once the genre exists, it kind of gets codified with certain like tropes and styles and that sort of thing. And one of the things that I really like about this book is it's talking about a lot of the same things that YA books would talk about, but it feels refreshing because it is not in the way that a lot of YA books, like, it doesn't approach it in the way that a lot of YA books do, you know, like a really kind of talky narrator with, like, you know, very vernacular first person narratives and, you know, not especially adventurous prose and like, I mean, I'm naming the negative qualities of YA genre. There's plenty of positive qualities, too. But, like, this book has a kind of flexibility of form that I don't know that it might not have if it were being marketed for YA and, like, conceived as a YA book.
Right.
And I just really like it. You know, it's, I think we talked about in the podcast that the ending doesn't quite work, but also, like, the weirdness of, like, the pacing and that sort of thing, I think, is part of what makes this book distinct. And it doesn't feel like sanded down. And I really appreciate that.
Something else I'll say is that so enjoyed our conversation about this book that I've gone back and listened to that podcast several times.
I really admire your ability to listen to yourself on recording.
I think that probably means that I'm more arrogant than you or something.
I don't think so. There's no reason that I shouldn't be able to listen to my own voice, but I do truly dislike hearing my own voice and hearing my thoughts too. I always think of better ways I could have said
them. No, I love it, and I loved the conversation that came out of that book as we were reading it and discussing it. And just also, I said this before, but the deep questions of faith on like a child's level is just superb. I just really think Katherine Patterson has a talent for capturing the really beautiful and really ugly parts of life. And, you know, she does that in Bridge to Terabithia. She does that in this book, with also the deep understanding of the capacity that humanity has to care for one another and hurt one another. And you get to see the best and worst of that in both of those books, I think. So anyway, this book is excellent. If you have not read it, go read it and then go listen to our podcast. Yes. About it. Our episode about it. You are listening to our podcast.
All right, hold on to your pants.
Okay.
This next category is a book that surprised you.
Okay.
So, you go what ahead. Book? Oh, so I'm going to start this time?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a book that surprised me, and I don't even remember if I talked about this on the podcast or not, but way back in the twilight months of, well, the early months of 2024, I read a book called Please Kill Me, an Uncensored Oral History of Punk. And like what it basically was is, you know, like an oral history where they've interviewed a lot of people and are kind of splicing those interviews together to make it kind of sound like a almost like a roundtable, you know, discussion or a documentary sort of talking head style thing. And it is about like kind of like the mid, like late 60s to like mid 70s, like American punk movement, which was mostly based in New York City and early on in Detroit, with bands like MC5 and Iggy Pop came out of, and the Stooges came out of Detroit as well. And I mean, this is music that I've enjoyed, you know, for like since I was a teenager. And I kind of, you know, I understood it's like, you know, cultural context and that sort of thing, like how punk, you know, was out, you know, this kind of like underground outsider thing that like really shifted how, you know, a lot of music was done and like, you know, this vibrant subculture in different cities and that sort of thing. So I came into this book kind of knowing the very big picture, 1,000-foot view of like what punk was and having listened to a lot of the records and stuff. But what I didn't know a lot of was the personalities and lives of the people involved in punk, especially at this stage, where a lot of these people don't really make it that far in like what will become punk, because a lot of punk changes when the British wave comes through, like the Clash and Sex Pistols and things like that. And this is specifically like the American wave before that. So you see like the Ramones are talked about and Patti Smith, and like I mentioned, like MC5 and like all those folks. And I guess the reason why I'm saying this book surprised me, and I don't know why I was surprised by this, but these, you know, given that like punk rock is known for being abrasive and stuff like that, I should have known. But like, I was very surprised at how unpleasant it would have been to have been in these scenes. Everyone was strung out on like heroin. Like everyone was were these like big cantankerous like abrasive personalities. Like you know, obviously there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. Like a lot of interesting connections to radical politics and stuff like that, but also just a lot of like people just treating people very poorly. And, you know, I don't know, you know, it talks about how like Iggy Pop would be like so strung out on drugs that they'd have to like basically prop him up on stage and he would like vomit on the fans and things like that. And that was just part of being punk. And like, I guess I knew that's what punk was like on an abstract level. But, like, the people that stuck around a long time, like Patti Smith or Iggy Pop or whatever, like, I kind of expected to be a bit more, I don't know, like, it's surprising they survived this, to be honest. And I guess I feel a little naive, you know, having, you know, obviously, like, all music scenes have their debauchery or have their, like, you know, squabbles and you know, big personalities and things like that. I guess I just didn't quite realize, you know, what it was like. And I came out of this, like, feeling like I understood the music better and the context of the music better, but also feeling like, boy, I'm glad I'm, like, in the comfort of my own home listening to this stuff rather than, you know, having it, you know, people throw, like, glass bottles at me from the stage rather than play the songs or, you know, that's not very punk of me to say, but, you know, and I'm glad this music got made, but, I was surprised at how much I came out thinking I didn't want to be there. Because usually it's the other way around. You read about, like, creators are like, wow, it'd be cool to have been there and seen that. And I came out of this thinking, I'm glad I didn't see that. Anyway, there's my very, like, suburban, uncool person take on a punk rock music. Rebecca, what surprised you?
Well, this is a major shift from the history of punk, but it also surprised me that this book surprised me. So I reread Little Women.
I would say Louisa May Alcott is very tuned into DIY culture.
Okay.
She's a punker. For sure.
Yeah, well, that's what surprised me about this book is that I talked about this in a previous episode, but those of you who know me know that Louisa May Alcott was one of my favorite authors as a kid, and Little Women specifically has been one of my favorite stories. I love the 1994 version with Winona Ryder. I love Greta Gerwig's version that came out in 2019 that really revived that story for me in some really beautiful ways. The way that she interpreted the story. That movie is just 100%, no flaws, okay? That movie is perfect, truly.
It's great. I would not say anyway, Greta Gerwig is very punk, but...
Listen, anyway, what surprised me about rereading Little Women this time is I was listening to a podcast called Joe's Boys while I was reading this that was basically applying queer literary criticism to this reading of Little Women. I had thought this for a while, just having, like, studied Louisa May Alcott's life and reading biographies and things. I have thought for a long time that Louisa was probably trans before they had, like, language for that. I say before they had language, but there were people who were openly homosexual, like, definitely people who were playing around with gender and gender identity, and I think of Virginia Woolf, and, you know, it was not...
She's a lot later than Louisa May Alcott, isn't she?
Yes, but there were definitely conversations happening. There were people who were living out. I mean, Walt Whitman was out. It was definitely not out of the realm of possibility for people to be exploring and pushing the boundaries of gender and gender expression and orientation, all of those things. But it also was not so much in the conversation as it was now. And so anyway, like, rereading Little Women while also listening to this podcast, I was really struck by, number one, how much of original dialogue in the text that Greta used in the movie Little Women. Because if you've seen the 2019 version, you know that it feels very modern at parts. And it is. It's intentionally playing with that modernity and the tradition of the story. But so much of that dialogue is pulled directly from Louisa's original text. So that was really fascinating to me. And I felt like watching Greta's movie for the first time made me fall in love with the story even more. And having seen her movie and revisited the story, I was ready to kind of be let down, and I wasn't at all. And so that was really wonderful. And just reading it through this different lens of what Louisa may have been experiencing, what her family's expectations of her would have been, what their expectations actually were. Like, Louisa was referred to by her nieces as uncle. at one point one of her sisters dies, and this is always hard to know, like, what pronouns do you use when that wasn't the conversation back then, but one of Luisa's sisters dies, and Luisa writes in a letter, now I have to be a father to these children. So things that are, like, explicitly there in her writings and in the text, you can see some of that come through. So it surprised me in a great way. I was really grateful I got the chance to read it again, and that so many people have done this story in a way that honors Luisa's life and legacy, and also, like, this beautiful book that she wrote. So, Michael, what is the book that made you laugh?
You know, I'll be honest, as I was looking through my what I've read this year, or last year, I guess, at this point, I didn't read a lot of funny books. and so this book is a book that's comical. So I didn't just pick, like, a bleak book and say, you know, I laughed at this one part. Like, this is a book that's intended to be funny. And it is funny. But I don't know if I ever really laughed. I might have done the little, like, puff of air through the nose sort of thing, you know, at a time reading this. So we're using laugh in a kind of generous way here. But I did enjoy this book. How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems by Randall Monroe. I'm fairly confident I talked about this on the podcast. But this is a book that is by the author of the internet comic XKCD. And so if you're familiar with the kind of visual style of that, it's like stick figures and stuff, and usually exploring jokes related to science or you know, those sorts of things, you know, kind of the STEM humor, you know, the famously hilarious world of STEM. But I mean, it is a genuinely funny comic. And so, like, the premise of this book is that it is taking normal problems like you need to move, and then explaining how to do so in increasingly ludicrous ways. So, like, you need to move. You know, the most obvious way is to get a truck and put your stuff in the truck and then drive the truck to the new house. But what if you don't want to do a truck? What if you want to move by hot air balloon? And so how do you do that? Or what if you want to move but stay in the same house? How do you do that? And so, like, it's this kind of just fooling around with, like, you know, taking simple problems and pushing them to an absurd degree of complexity. And if that sounds funny to you as I'm describing it, then this book is maybe for you. If that doesn't sound funny to you, then this book is probably not for you. It's a very particular sort of thing that you have to find funny. And I did. It's not like it's not a laugh riot, but it's amusing, and it's kind of it's funny to see, like, where he pushes things and where he goes with that. So what book did you find funny, Rebecca?
I read Ferris by Kate DiCamillo. And this book was just delightful. I love Kate, as anyone who has listened to this podcast knows. And this book she wrote in, it was published at the beginning of 2024, so fairly new. But this is about a little girl named Ferris Wilkie. It's the summer before fifth grade. She has a little sister who is a little tyrant. Like, when I say tyrant, I mean this child pulled her teeth out with pliers. Like, that's the kind of, like, chaotic energy we're talking about with her. She wants to be an outlaw, and so she runs over town, all around town, doing chaotic things. Anyway, this book is just a perfect example of what Kate is really, really good at. Capturing the heart of children, having really lively characters, having such a beautiful balance of joy and laughter and sadness. And basically, this book centers around Ferris is worried about her grandmother, Charisse, who is feeling unwell. And Charisse has also begun to see a ghost at the threshold of her room, and Ferris is afraid that, this ghost is trying to take her from them, to take her in death to the other side, the gray beyond, as they say. But instead, this ghost is haunting this old home that Ferris and her family lives in because this ghost wants the chandelier lit with all the candles in it, every single candle. And so they're on this mission to light this chandelier. And along the way, they have so many wonderful adventures. But this book is truly delightful. If you want a quick, lighthearted read that will make you laugh and cry and feel deep things, this is the one for you.
I should have read that one.
So, yeah, it's great. You still can.
I've still only read one Kate DeCamillo book.
Oh, Michael, it's a travesty.
I know. There's a lot to read. When we get to the book I'm proud of myself for reading, we'll talk about how much that there is to read.
Okay.
What's our next category? It made you cry, right?
Is that? It can be, yeah.
I think laugh and cry, those are good, like, yeah. Dichotomies. Yeah. What book made you cry, Rebecca?
Well, I just talked about a book.
Oh, my gosh, you're going to make me cry. book that made me cry... I don't know that I actually shed a tear, but definitely my heart was sick having read this book for a couple of reasons. So I chose The Parable of the Talents by Octavia Butler, which is the second and sadly last book that Octavia Butler wrote in what was initially supposed to be a trilogy about this woman growing up in a post, I guess it's not exactly post-apocalyptic America, a dystopian America where climate change and drug addiction and a collapsing federal government have resulted in an America that is quite harsh, harsher than the one we live in. In the midst of this, she is trying to found her own religion, like kind of like an offshoot of Christianity. And so the book is supposed to be kind of like a, almost like a biography of like a person who becomes like a kind of, like a religious figure in the scope of history, you know, like a Joseph Smith or a Buddha or that sort of thing, or a Jesus. The reason, though, that this made me feel sick and at least metaphorically cry is that it's just, you know, you read dystopian fiction and people are always like, oh, wow, you know, this book predicted things. You know, people read like 1984 and, you know, it invites comparison with the world that you live in. Or you read Brave New World and it invites, you know, those books exist to compare to the world that you live in. But like, man... this one was too close for comfort. I read this prior to the November 2024 election in the United States, but the writing was already kind of on the wall by the time I was reading it. You know, it was not looking good, and even if the election had gone differently in November, the contingent that supports Donald Trump would still exist in a sizable portion of America. And in The Parable of the Talents, there is a Christian nationalist, authoritarian, strongman president elected who I don't think Make America Great Again is the exact term that he uses, but it is something very similar to that. I'm trying to remember what it is. And like, this guy has none of the kind of like rambly, chaotic qualities of Donald Trump. Like, it's more like if J.D. Vance was our president in the book. But regardless... it's not great. You know, they eventually make like concentration camps that they call re-education camps, where they put people who don't like conform to their specific sect of Christianity to be like forcibly converted, kind of like America, like the United States did to indigenous peoples, you know, and they even do this to other Christians who they don't consider the right kind of Christian and that sort of thing. And they, you know, there's obviously a lot of the rhetoric is very similar to what we see out of like the Republican Party these days, you know, which is like openly antagonistic toward like certain people groups, certain vulnerable minorities, scapegoating, you know, big systemic problems on like different types of people. Anyway, Octavia Butler's been dead for a few years now, so I'm kind of glad for her that she didn't have to live to see like one of her novels like so eerily parallel our world. There are ways it doesn't parallel our world. You know, we're not really living in the United States where, you know, you're going to be attacked by roaming gangs, you know, out in the hinterlands of the West that is no longer irrigated because of climate change. Like, you know, we're not living in exactly the world of this book, but like it was a lot closer to like what I've been seeing in the real world than I wished it were. And you know, obviously those problems have not gone away and they've continued to get worse on a daily basis. So did not feel good reading that book. It is a good book, but did not feel good reading that in our current situation. Rebecca, it's your turn.
Yes, I read an essay collection by Ann Patchett called These Precious Days. And I have loved Anne's fiction for a couple years now. And this past year, I had an opportunity to read several of her works of nonfiction. And I was very pleasantly surprised that I think her nonfiction is even better than her fiction. And these essays, just every one was so beautiful and so sincere. And early in the book, I don't want to give things away, but there's a significant loss that happens in this book that you kind of like see coming, but you don't want to know that it is coming. And when it happens, the way that she honors this friend is, I don't know the word for it. I didn't want to stop using the word incredible or super or strong or whatever. There's not a good adjective to capture it. And Anne Anne Patchett has had several significant losses. She writes very beautifully of taking care of her grandmother in her old age. I can't remember if that's this book or this is The Story of a Happy Marriage. I think it's this, The Story of a Happy Marriage. But she lost her grandmother after being her primary caretaker for a while. One of her best friends died of an overdose after surviving cancer multiple times. And then she loses this friend. And so to hear her talk about death in a way that really captures the hardest feelings of it without resorting to despair, and in a way that can honor their lives instead of just missing them, even though she does really miss them, is something that I truly admire and has really made me think about how we love people well when we have them and what it looks like to celebrate them when they're gone and to celebrate them when you know that they are about to be gone. So it just made me ask some really profound questions and think maybe a little bit too deeply about how I would experience that if I lost people who were close to me. But in a very beautiful way that, and I just think right now I'm thinking about that I'm talking about this in the season of Lent, where that's what we're all kind of reflecting on is our mortality and how we take care of each other because of that. That could be what we're thinking about. It doesn't feel like nationally that's what we're thinking about, but I think that we are invited into this tradition.
I thought America was so back. Are we not? Yeah. Are we not so back to taking care of each other?
I just am grateful to have authors like Anne who are very honest about life, but can write about them so beautifully and tell really, really good stories about people that she loves. And I wish I could remember the exact essays that were in this one, but I get it very confused with another essay collection. This is The Story of a Happy Marriage, both of which you should read. Reading essays is a beautiful thing. It is short, sweet. You don't have to finish the whole book. You can pick it up, read something else, revisit it. Feel uplifted for a while. Think about deep things. So anyway,
I used to read essay collections all the time. I don't know why I got out of the habit.
I want to read more, and that's going to be a goal of mine this year, is to make more time for just reading wonderful essays. Which is so funny that we don't read essay collections when you think about how much of how we learned to write was through these personal narratives and through essays, which I really enjoyed writing, but I don't read a lot of them.
I do think that people read essays that aren't identified as essays. So like nonfiction is very popular, including a lot of nonfiction that's very like reflective and like often like tied to personal experience. And like if you just kind of restructured those just a little bit, I think they would basically be essays.
Yeah. So that was just a delightful read and made me cry in the best cathartic way. I remember where I was when I listened to the end of this book. So yeah, it's definitely worth your time.
Before we go into the next category, I'm sure no one else cares about this, but it will bother me if I don't correct myself. In the Parable of the Talents, the president's actually does use the campaign slogan, Make America Great Again.
Are you serious?
He does, yeah. Although, as many people have noted, Donald Trump has plagiarized this from Ronald Reagan.
Oh, okay.
So I imagine that's what Octavia Butler was thinking back to. However, yet another parallel. It wasn't just a phrase like Make America Great Again. It actually was Make America Great Again. Mm-hmm. Yet another reason to cry. What's our next category, Rebecca?
Our next.
My notes are in a different order than yours now.
That's okay. You can do your next one.
Okay. The book that made me think. Is that what's next for you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like I said, I didn't read a lot of very funny books this year. And this is a very not funny book, but it made me think a lot. It's a nonfiction book called After Black Lives Matter by Cedric G. Johnson, which I may have talked about on the podcast. I read it over the summer. I kind of picked it up on a whim because I thought it looked interesting, and it was by a publisher that, you know, I've gotten good books from before, Verso. And basically, this is like a critique of Black Lives Matter. And when I say critique, I don't necessarily mean all negative. It's, I guess, more of an analysis of Black Lives Matter and kind of examining like the movement's successes and shortcomings, largely from the perspective of someone who is more left-wing than Black Lives Matter. And I think for some people that might be surprising. How can you be more left-wing than Black Lives Matter? And basically how he frames it is that Black Lives Matter is a liberal project, you know, that is focused on human rights, but that he thinks that they should have been, like, one of the fundamental failures of Black Lives Matter was not connecting those civil rights to material issues such as wages or unionization or workplace safety, since those issues, you know, and class issues in general disproportionately affect Black people, since Black people are also more, you know, as a trend, like, poorer than, you know, a lot of other groups. And he also said this would have created a better multiracial coalition to support the, you know, policy goals of Black Lives Matter too. And his basic vision is that, like, Black Lives Matter should have been a kind of racially infused version of the New Deal, with like advocating for things like the WPA and things like that. And he said, like, that would have uplifted Black folks a whole lot more than, like, basically the symbolic victories that Black Lives Matter ended up getting. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, it's easy to Monday morning quarterback this stuff. I think that it is fairly obvious now that, like, 2020 was the last year that Black Lives Matter had, like, made significant political inroads. And, like, a lot of activism of the Obama and Trump first term, it's kind of imploded over the Biden years. And I don't know, maybe it made me think, like I said, and it's hard to know what would have happened otherwise. Would Would it have collapsed as much? Would it have had the backlash that it did? If it had been tied more toward, like, you know, quote unquote, like working class issues. I don't know, but I think these are good things to think about as we think about how our world could be made better. So,
yeah,
what would you think about, Rebecca?
I read The House of the Spirits by Isabel Allende, and that book was so great. It's this sweeping tale of multi-generations of this one family, some of whom gain power in conservative government, some of whom are connected to the leftist government that is also taking power, and then follows through the coup of the military and the takeover by a right-wing form of government. And Isabel intentionally does not ever say what Latin American country her books are set in, but it's very clear that this is based off of, it's a fictional tale, very much influenced by the military coup d'etat that happened in Chile, of which her cousin was the president. And
the president deposed by the coup.
Right. Sorry, I didn't explain that very well. I was about to say who died by suicide when he was being taken out of power. And Isabel and her family were forced into exile, and she wrote this book. This was her first novel, which is incredible to think about. This was your first novel. And she wrote it while she was in exile in Venezuela from Chile. I also had the beautiful opportunity of going to Chile this year and getting to see, getting to visit Pablo Neruda's house. And she talks about Pablo quite a bit in the book without naming him. He's the poet. And so getting to read that story and do a little bit of research about the real life politics, what was going on in that day, and then to see his house where that was looted after the military takeover, the place where after his funeral people gathered in protest, which his funeral was the first major protest against the military takeover. And so to see all of those things in person after having read this story was a true gift, and I was really, really grateful to have that opportunity. But it's been a while since I've read it. I wish I could remember details a little bit better, but one thing I remember that stood out to me was just how surprised people were when the military took over, and people that did have power who were on their side, I'm saying that in quotation marks, how they were deposed to and how they lost things to. And just the question of, just the question of who has our best interests at heart, who has the best interest of the most vulnerable at heart, and what can happen when you have power-hungry individuals who have been taught to just comply with authority, and that is the number one thing that makes the world go round. When that's your philosophy, the harm that can happen from that, and just your relationships with your family and how they can be destroyed. Anyway, I didn't say that very eloquently, but that book is truly wonderful. It's magical realism, so it's it's this wonderful blend of things that you could see happening in real life and things that are so imaginative and incredible and really just take you by surprise. So that book made me think. What book do you really want to talk about?
Well, this one was easy. Earlier in 2024, I guess in the fall of 2024, I read Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. And, Thomas Pynchon, the very famous and famously reclusive novelist who wrote such things as Inherent Vice and Gravity's Rainbow and Mason and Dixon. And over the past few years, I've become a pretty big fan of Thomas Pynchon. And he's one of these authors that you either like to talk about him or you don't. And I don't have a lot of people in my life who like to talk about Thomas Pynchon. So I'm left with a lot of pent-up...
Pynchon energy.
Pent-up Pynchon energy, yeah. And so, you know, I would talk about Vineland in general, or specifically, but I would also like to talk about Pynchon specific, or in general, you know, like, just wish more people would read him. I mean, it's understandable why more people don't read him. Like, he writes these, you know, in kind of intricate postmodern novels, but I think they're also very human. A lot of times postmodernism has this reputation in literature of being these kind of like cold, like analytical novels, or just like stylistic experiments. And I think that he's got plenty of stylistic experimentation, but I think he truly cares about his characters and makes memorable characters. He's also very funny. A lot of silly, just like puns and, you know, wordplay and that sort of thing. Also, maybe more people will want to talk to me about Vineland in a few months, because I think that the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie has, I believe, wrapped production at this point, and it is supposed to be an adaptation of Vineland, although modernized a little bit. Vineland takes place in 1984, and is about aging hippies, and I'm curious what form the movie takes, but maybe a few more people want to talk about Pynchon after that movie comes out. I'm looking forward to the movie. Hope it's good. I'd like to talk more about these weird stoner guys that Thomas Pynchon likes to write about and how they butt up against enormous conspiracies. It's good stuff. I've enjoyed every one of his books that I've read. Looking forward to reading more in 2025, perhaps. What book would you want to talk about, Rebecca?
I chose the book that I've been talking about to people all year.
I think you have talked about this book a lot. It's good, though.
Sorry. Well, I won't spend a lot of time on it, but James by Percival Everett won the National Book Award last year. Was definitely well-earned. That book made me think. That book made me cry. That book, maybe really a lot of these categories it fulfills, but
was it your favorite Newbery?
No, it wasn't that. I'm trying to think of what to say briefly about this for people that are interested or why it was so compelling to me, but I really loved how Percival Everett is not trying to undo the story of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. Because this is a very different book. It's not hijinks. It's not really about the relationship between... I mean, it's not really a story about this little boy. It is, but it's about so much more. And I think that Huck Finn, for all of its faults, is a great novel. And I think that it... has a lot of like important social commentary. And so to have James exist, written by a black man from the perspective of a black man, seeing the way that he reverses your expectations of what would have been expected of slaves during the day, and this beautiful retelling of how they educated themselves and had to fit into these roles to satisfy the expectations of white people, and also this deep longing to live a life of freedom captured within this world of Huck Finn. I thought it was just such a strong, beautiful book, and I was really grateful to have read it and to tell other people to read it. And
you got it for me for, was it my birthday?
Yes.
It was good. I read it. Yeah. I appreciate you getting it for me.
Yeah. So anyway, I think we need to read more books like this that is really listening to the voices of people whose stories have been told by white people for so long. And it's very well done. The dialogue is great. The prose is magnificent. There's not a lot of like wasted time or space in this book. I just think it's a very excellent novel. So
nice. So this brings us to our last category. Book that I'm proud of myself for reading. And this is what I was talking about when there's a lot of books to read. I'm proud of myself for having read the book Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, which was also a book that I think Rebecca talked about the previous year that
we did this, right? I'm just looking at this cover on your screen and like the eye of Armie Hammer.
Oh, is... yeah. So this the cover of the book page that I have pulled up is the movie tie-in with the Netflix Daphne du Maurier film, which has Armie Hammer. But anyway, Rebecca is a book that has been on my radar for a very long time, and I've been intending to read for a very long time, probably since I saw the Alfred Hitchcock movie when I was like in high school or something like that. I just had never gotten around to it. And there are so many books that exist like that, where it's like, I've just never gotten around to reading it. I've always intended to read it. Little Women is one of those, in fact, for me, where there's just lots of books. Many of them are on our bookshelf here in our living room. And I'm just proud of myself for finally having checked one off. And
after his own Rebecca read it.
After my own Rebecca. And loved
it. And then we read it as a book club.
It took Rebecca to make me read Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did. It's a great novel, really fun, really great prose, really engaging story, really interesting and surprisingly ambiguous story. What are we supposed to think about the narrator? What are we supposed to think about Maxim, who...
I have very clear opinions about Maxim. Well,
I guess what I mean by ambiguous is what is the author's... Yes. Point of view, and I guess authorial point of view, like what are the themes of the book, I think are like really interesting to talk about. Like Rebecca mentioned, we did this as kind of like a book club with one of our friends, and we all, I think, really enjoyed it. For Rebecca, it was a reread, but for me and our friend, it was a first time read, and we were both really, really engaged. It's a great little gothic novel, kind of in the tradition of Jane Eyre or that kind of book, but modernized to the early 20th century, but also modernized morally, where there's a lot of like moral ambiguity or even just like amorality, you know. Yes. By the end of the book,
I feel there's a lot of amorality.
Yeah. And I thought it was very good. I'm really proud of, I don't know, proud of myself, self-aggrandizing, I guess, but I'm glad I did it. A book that I've known existed for probably 20 years I finally have read. What are you proud of yourself for having read?
I finished a very hefty biography of Martin Luther King Jr. called King by Jonathan Eich. This book came out...
It might have been in 2024.
I think it was 2023. I don't remember. But anyway, this book was very large, and it took me a very long time. But I am very glad that I read it.
It was 2023.
Okay, so this book came out after some of the FBI tapes were released, but not all of them, where Dr. King's like phone calls and conversations were tapped. But I don't know a lot of what to say about this book, except I feel like it really captures Dr. King's nuance that we don't necessarily hear in the larger conversation. Also, it really captures how beloved Dr. King is now, but at the time, I mean, we know this because he was killed, but even while having like a lot of conversations with people in power, how hated he was by them as well, what a nuisance he was to them. And the part that they played in leading to his assassination, you know, while they might not have, I'm not like being a conspiracy theorist here, but like the lack of protection he was given, the messages that were spewed about him by J. Edgar Hoover, the lack of respect that LBJ had for him behind his back. It just, I don't know, it was very, very, I don't know what I'm trying to say, you guys, but it was very enlightening about his life and who are our heroes now, what they would have looked like in the present day. And I just am thinking about that a lot right now. Who are people right now that hopefully, like many years down the road, people will respect as these really courageous people who stood up for what was right, whereas now they might be seen as rabble-rousers or troublemakers or, I don't know, whatever nuisance adjective you wanna make. And what courage it takes to be those people who stand up for what's right. And how comfortable you have to feel, or not comfortable, but how much you have to not care about what people think, because your life and your livelihood and the livelihood of your family and your friends is at stake. So anyway, I thought it was a really well done biography, and also was one of those that I kind of was also depressed at the end of it, because I, if I remember correctly, I does this conversation about what the legacy of Dr. King, how it has, the way that it is talked about now or honored. I say now, maybe just a few years ago, because I think the conversation has shifted in a very ugly way about leaders like Dr. King. But anyway, just talking about the legacy of Dr. King now, the way that that message is shared has really taken away a lot from what he was fighting for and how much work is left to be done. And so I thought that was really insightful, but it's really well done biography, and it was worth the time it took to read it.
I would really like to read it. A few years back, I went through and read a bunch of his writings, his being Dr. King's, including a bunch of speeches. And it really is wild, the things that man, you know, was standing for once you get outside of the big hits, you know.
What I will also say is this is not a hagiographic like biography either. He's very honest about his faults. He's very honest about how Coretta was treated, which was not right. So I think it does a good job of like capturing a lot of those elements that we might not want to talk about.
Well, I guess what I meant was just politically, you know, we're from the most iconic King stuff is fairly early in his career. Mm-hmm. The bus boycott, mm-hmm. I Have a Dream. Mm-hmm. Whereas the stuff that is really still shocking today is the stuff he did in the years leading up to his death and what probably got him, you know, killed. You know, his support for labor organizing or his opposition to the Vietnam War, which
was strong opposition to the Vietnam War,
which is what soured his relationship with LBJ, yes. If I remember right.
Yes, you are correct. Yes.
Which, you know, says a lot about Lyndon Baines Johnson. is there an S on Baines or is it just Baines?
I don't know.
Anyway, I could go on, but I really would like to read this, what I'm saying.
I thought it was really well done, and it was very engaging, and uses a lot of letters and personal interviews and things, because, you know, sometimes biographies can just be boring. I didn't find this one to be boring. It was just hefty. So.
Hefty.
Anyway, that's our year in review.
So tune in next time when our regularly scheduled programming resumes. I say this at the end of every podcast. I should stop saying this, but hopefully it'll be out sooner than the interval between our last one. But Rebecca and I have actually both finished this book at this point, which is the
I have not actually finished.
Oh.
I just have
nearly finished. We're reading David Egger's The Eye and the Impossible.
Eyes and the Impossible.
The Eyes and the Impossible. I'll get names right eventually. I hope you'll join us then for that sure to be exciting podcast. Do you have anything else to say before we sign off?
No, Rebecca? Keep reading. And if you want to share your list with us, we would love to hear what you would recommend, whether they be these categories or ones that you make up for yourself. That's been one of the greatest joys this past year, is just talking to people about what they're reading and getting recommendations and sharing ones with them. It's just a gift. So Newbery, thank you guys for listening.
NewberryChronicles@gmail.com. Yeah. Talk to you later.